you have a writing voice too. And this goes back to early writing center stuff here 25 years ago. What is your writing voice? And journaling about whatever you want to, whatever you're passionate about, whatever's on your mind, whatever you've observed about the world today, is a step in finding and becoming comfortable with and ultimately confident with that writing voice.
So a lot of what I'm hearing is that what you all are doing is, one, there's no doubt you're teaching writing. You're mm-hmm. teaching how to read. You're teaching symbolism. I want to ask a bit more about that. But you're really teaching about how to experience life more fully mm-hmm. and how to describe life more fully to other people. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yeah. That's definitely, actually, I years ago I put in my syllabus, you can't write if you can't observe. And then I added to it, and to live a better life, you need to observe, that these things are connected.
Maybe they even get tired of it, but a sophomore is pretty inward looking. The world, as far as they see it, is primarily about themselves for the most part. And so when you ask a kid to write about himself, to think about himself, to sort of work through and flesh out what it is that makes him who he is, and you compare that with a great book as sort of a trampoline or a jumping off point, then they get okay doing it again. And so then it just becomes, okay, we're going to shift to a different text. The idea is the same. We admit that this is good literature, and it's good because it says some sort of truth about the world. What is that truth, and how does it apply to you?
Hello, and welcome to Stories from the Ridge, a podcast series of the Macaulay School. I'm Lee Burns, head of school, and today it's my privilege to welcome you to a great discussion among three of our teachers in the English department. This is part of our series of podcast discussions we're featuring on the academic departments at Macaulay. Earlier, we posted a discussion with our science department, and over the next several weeks, we'll post discussions with other departments. In today's podcast, Dean of Faculty and Curriculum Sumner Macaulay sits down with Department Chair Sam Curran and teachers Bill Jamison and Aaron Tocknell in a fascinating conversation of how teaching the subject of English has changed at Macaulay over the years, and also how the objectives have changed. As I listened to this conversation, I was impressed by how each teacher sees himself or herself as part of a team, and how they collaborate and support each other. This is not only true within the English department, it's also true among the various departments. There is so much collaboration throughout the academic program. Another thing I think you'll observe is how much these teachers like and respect each other. That's something that's critical to successful teaching, and it is something we work hard at Macaulay to nurture. I hope you enjoy this English department discussion, and that you'll join us throughout the next couple of months as we offer similar lively discussions about other academic disciplines. Now let's join Sumner, Sam, Bill, and Aaron.
Well, welcome. I'm Sumner Macaulay. I'm the Dean of Faculty and Curriculum here at Macaulay School, and we continue our podcast focusing on different academic departments. And today we have English, three fantastic folks from our English department. And let me ask them to introduce themselves first and share a little background about themselves and then their role here, and then we'll get started with our conversation.
I'm Sam Curran. I've been here since 2010. I teach 10th grade honors world literature, and I recently started teaching some senior electives. So those have been fun and eye-opening, to say the least, having seniors.
I'm Aaron Tocknell. I've been here since 2007. In that time, I've taught 9th and 11th grade, but most of my time has been spent in 10th grade. So I teach several sections of world literature, and I also am the faculty sponsor for the school literary journal, The Argonaut, and I do the Residential Life Community Service Program.
And I'm Bill Jamison. I teach 8th grade English. I taught 9th and 10th grade when I first came, which was approximately 40 years ago.
The wise sage that all of us.
Well, the nice thing is that Sam outranks me. He's the chairman of the department.
That's great. So Sam, in fact, let me start with you if I can. Maybe start us off with two or three main themes when you think about teaching English. And it's obviously been something we've done for a long time in education. But two or three main themes that are emerging or that have emerged over the past 5 years in English.
One, and I'll tee up Bill and Aaron too on this, is that grammar instruction doesn't look like it used to. I think that's sort of a big one. And philosophically, we really sort of teach it like practice. We want our guys writing a lot, and then through that process of discovering, you know, what makes a good sentence and what doesn't, we pick and choose times to say, okay, here's a comma splice. This is why a comma splice. This is what a comma splice is. Here's the three ways you fix it. And so it's less rote. You know, we don't have a grammar textbook anymore. We want guys to write and then discover on their own sort of what good writing looks like. The second sort of related idea to that is, and this sort of started with Ken Henry, who just retired, who would have been a great addition to this podcast, was really, really intentional writing time. So setting aside a full rotation in class where the teacher's present, every resource they need is available. And the other thing that this comes from is we sort of discovered that to ask a sophomore to spend an hour working on a paper after he's done sports, dinner, you know, study hall where he's got chemistry, Spanish, algebra, that we weren't getting 50 good minutes of work out of them. And so to have the teacher sit with the students in class where they can come up, and with Google Docs you can look over their shoulder and they can, you know, we can work really intently on that. I think over the past 5 years those have been thematically sort of the biggest shifts in the department.
That makes sense. Okay, so Bill, maybe plunge into that initially. So grammar, and I remember visiting your class year before, and having conversations with you about new ways you were thinking about teaching grammar. And it was amazing to me because the idea of a new way to teach grammar was foreign to me. I thought there was only kind of the main way that I learned. So talk to me about that. You've really evolved on that.
And it remains new. I mean, in a way, every time I walk in that room, something might be new. I'll give you the example just from today. I had found I think this was either from the New Yorker or the Far Side, I forget which. In the cartoon, I put it up on the screen, and it has two kids looking at a swing set with broken chains and no swings. And one of the kids is saying, it don't mean a thing, and that's all that's there. And so I said, all right, guys, what does that mean? I said, I'm going to tell you, you probably don't know because there's a cultural reference at work here.
Right. Right.
And so they scratch their heads and they don't know. So I said, all right, I'm going to show you something. And I showed them a 30-second clip of Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington. And they're actually tapping their feet. There's a really good drummer in this piece.
Nice.
And I said, and then they heard Ella, and one of the kids go, I got it. And of course, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And they all of a sudden understood the cartoon. Well, then I updated them with another one. I said, this guy's name is Tony Bennett, and you probably don't know the lady that he's singing with. And sure enough, I played him 45 seconds of Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett singing the same song, and only one or two guys knew it was Lady Gaga.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, cultural references have a very small half-life in some cases.
Yep, yep.
One class, we even looked up a Lady Gaga in a strips of meat dress. But the bottom line was, it was stunning. Bottom line is we ended up looking at the word swing as a noun, as an adjective, and as a verb. Three different kinds of uses for it. And then I had three volunteers come up, and I'd put some pieces of paper on the board with a bunch of adjectives, and I had one boy stand there with an LV sign for the linking verb, and another boy come up and play subjects. And for the next few minutes, we simply put together sentences pointing out how important the linking verb was to creating that sentence. And this even required them to link. And boys don't like to hold hands, so today we use the Roman method, where they clasped their forearms, but we added a hip beat there so that it was very, very, and of course then they began to laugh, so we got that part over with, and for 15 minutes we created sentences And it's conceptual, and yes, we're not going to have that kind of fun every day. But it created a willingness to go, oh, okay, so that's what those words are and why they're even necessary and what it is they do.
So this is a real far cry from images of, here's the worksheet of sentences that I'm going to have to diagram.
You could get away with that. I mean, I've still got a set of Warriner's grammar books in my room, and they've got dust on them. It just won't work anymore. It hadn't worked for a good while. And so every day that I end up going in there, it's just a matter of how can I make this somehow accessible and somehow mean something in their life? Not, you know, in a religious way almost, but just so that it has a hook they can go, all right, I got it now. And I see what that, because a couple of boys did. They said, oh, I see now what you're doing, when we could take a predicate noun and reverse with the subject because they are the same person, they can play opposite. Well, you can do that in a Warriner's book in an exercise, and it's as dry as dirt, and nobody remembers it.
Yeah.
It's just different every day you walk in.
Aaron, you also do a lot of teaching of writing.
Yeah.
Right. And talk to me a little bit, and you do a range of students, right? You have some of our students who are coming to us that maybe haven't had necessarily a lot of background.
Mm-hmm.
They're in 10th grade. We know we want to prepare them really well for college and beyond. And so you have a group that you're working with, and then you have sort of a general group in your classes. What have you seen in terms of the teaching of writing in the past 4 or 5 years? And maybe it's grammar, but maybe it's something else. You do a lot with descriptive writing.
Yeah, I've changed from, I think when I first started teaching here in 2007, narrative writing, I think conceptually we almost thought of it as like a break, right? Like you're going to write an analytical paper on the Great Gatsby, and then we're going to let you have a little bit of fun. You're going to write about, you know, your own experience tromping in the woods for Huckleberry Finn or something like that. And then, I mean, what I've discovered, though, is that, and I think a lot of the department does this as well, is that you have to be able to analyze work to be able to write narratively. And that's really what a lot of sophomore year is moving towards, is the ability to really be good analysts of what you're reading and to understand. So tomorrow I'm going to walk into class after teaching A Private Experience by Chimamanda Adichie, and I'm going to ask them, okay, what did this writer do and how did she do it? And that I love that question, because it opens up both how did this writer make you feel, and then you get into, well, how did she do that, you know? And then you can, depending on the class, you can go from really general plot to, sometimes the classes will pick up on the dialogue and how short and clipped it is, or, you know, that this particular paragraph is describing what the woman sold at the market, and it's using these concrete nouns. And so that tends to be how I come into grammar, such as it is in my classes. How are these pieces organized? And how is that effective? And so at the end of this unit, when I ask you to write a story connected to the danger of a single story, to Chimamanda Adichie's TED Talk, you know, what are you gonna do, and how are you gonna do it? I don't get into grammar at the sentence level, I feel like, as much as I should. I feel like it's a challenge that I kind of walk up against every year and try to figure out. But working with the papers and thinking a lot about organization at the paragraph level and how that works, and also how do you include detail? What even is detail? You know, you can't just put a bunch of adjectives in a paper. If you say, you know, they wrote a paper last night about a family meal, and I say, if you say that family meal was good and so delicious and your family is the best and you love them, you have told me nothing, right? But if you bring out, you know, fried chicken and green beans, or chicken tiki masala, or, you know, whatever it is, if you really bring that out and bring in everything that's going on around you, then I do know a lot about your family and you, which at this point in the year is what we're trying to do. I'm trying to get to know them.
So how do we get them? I mean, one is to ask them to think about descriptive language, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Bill, my guess is in the 8th grade, your level is going to be a little bit of a different level than, Aaron, what you see in 10th grade, or what you, Sam, see in 10th grade honors. How do you get them to think on that level of description, on that level, that deeper level of what's going on around them? Because you're essentially asking them to look at the world more deeply. It happens to be through your literature, and then write about it more deeply, not just the surface. How do you go about doing that? Maybe start with Bill and then...
Well, I was going to say, it won't be the same in the eighth grade as it is in the high school, but there's a great scene in Romeo and Juliet where Juliet has gone to the friar for help because she's about to have to be forced married with Paris. And as fate would have it, she runs into Paris. He's there talking to the friar himself, and there's this one page of dialogue in the book, and it's, and I always have the boys, I said, don't even read it. Just don't read it. Let's hold it up. And I hold my book up and said, just hold that out at arm's length, and you tell me what's going on there. Tell me what relationship they have. And the boys see it immediately. It's clipped, it's short, it's all little short sentences, and it has the equivalent of the kind of thing you would say, how's the weather today? Fine. What you been doing? Nothing. It's that kind of thing. And they realized by looking at it, we don't even read it, that those two have no love for each other whatsoever because it's so different, and this is where they say, every time she speaks to Romeo, it's not that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even in the eighth grade, you can see those things, and then we'll explore. Well, let's see what they say to each other. And it's always more beautiful than how's the weather.
Yeah, that's a wonderful description. Yeah. And that's typically where 13-year-olds are, sort of, as we come home at night, sort of what, yeah. There's clearly love there, but that's sort of
how
what parents
school?
Have probably experienced,
yeah.
Right? How was school?
It's okay.
Okay, so they move from that, beginning to see it, to what happens in the 10th grade or in upper classes? How do you draw out that love of language, that beauty in the language that you're seeing?
And I'm like Aaron, and I think we've taught 10th grade together for a long time, and I feel like we're really comfortable in that class. And I think what she does with detail so well, I focus on structure, and, because we teach them the five-paragraph essay, and the guys that see that not as as sort of a formula or a template, but really just an idea, then they're okay. It's the guys that are stuck in, you know, this idea that something has to be somewhere. Somebody was teaching direct objects one time, and they had two sentences on the board. They said, the dog chased the ball, the cat chased the dog. Kid said, he said, well, where's the direct object? And in the first sentence, it was the dog. And the dog was the subject of the second sentence. And the second sentence, he said, okay, where's the direct object? The kid said, it's the dog. He said, no. He said, well, it was the dog in the first one. It's got to be the dog again. And some guys get kind of caught structurally in this idea that you have to have three paragraphs in your bodies and there's an introduction and a conclusion. And the example I always give them, and it pisses them off a lot because I don't tell them how many paragraphs are this. I say, yeah. Structure is a tool, you know, use it. And I say, if Mr. Burns sends me an email and says, give me an update on the English department, it doesn't come with a rubric. It doesn't come with a word length. And I have to make my own decisions in terms of the best places to organize it so that it's clear and concise. So we help them focus on thinking and sort of becoming their own best editor, and that starts with a five-paragraph essay, but the quicker they can scrap that template, the better, I think.
And then going off of what Sam was saying with getting into description and detail, I've done, I guess, I mean, the year's, about 10 days old now, but I've already had some fun with some of this stuff. So one thing that I did on the first day of school was I had them introduce themselves, and then I did the dreaded, you know, and give me one word to describe your summer. And you ended up with busy, exciting, surprising, fun, you know, just a lot. And then I pointed at it and I said, do we know anything about each other at this point? And no, not really, you know. And so then I said, all right, so I pulled in an example of a poem by a professor I had in college, Jim Daniels. He wrote a poem called The Eternal Moment of Running Wicked Fast. And it's just this breathless paragraph of what's clearly children having foot races down the street at dusk in the summer. And we talked about how all the different devices that were used there. And, you know, there's repetition and onomatopoeia and, you know, verbs. I mean, it's really great. And so then I said, okay, so now give me a word to describe your summer. And that's when I got, wake surfing is very big right now, where you surf behind a boat. And you know, deep sea fishing. You know, I got a list, and then we looked at that, and that was, you know, that was pretty great and much more descriptive. But I do think one of my classes had Bill, because this was my only plan for the first day of school, and then my seventh period comes in and they immediately hit like all the concrete nouns and verbs, and I was like, well, let's just talk and get to know each other then. But you know,
my very first journal entry for guys is this. It has been for the last couple of years. I say, okay, we admit that the first day back is a bittersweet experience, which gives us a chance to define bittersweet. And then I say, all right, I want you, all of us are going to miss summer, like I already miss summer. What I want you to do is to go home and write what I'm going to miss about this past summer, or if I could create the perfect summer day, what would it include? Now, we're not talking about great writing that comes out of this, but it's a journal, which is not, they know I'm not grading it with a red pen. And it's amazing how, in some cases, beautifully they describe things that they only wish could happen one more time. Mm-hmm. And it's the beginning of what Aaron's talking about, and what Sam's talking about is later on they'll learn how to really develop and sharpen those skills. But if they'll just be unafraid to express them in the eighth grade, that's good.
So a lot of what I'm hearing is that what you all are doing is, one, there's no doubt you're teaching writing. You're mm-hmm. teaching how to read. You're teaching symbolism. I want to ask a bit more about that. But you're really teaching about how to experience life more fully mm-hmm. and how to describe life more fully to other people. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yeah. That's definitely, actually, years ago I put in my syllabus, you can't write if you can't observe. And then I added to it, and to live a better life, you need to observe, that these things are connected. If I ask you to describe a meal at your family house and you've never really paid attention to anything in your house, then, you know, or, you know, I don't know, the tone of your mother's voice or something like that, then you are going to have a hard time. That the ability to see and the ability to write is deeply connected. So what I do is once a week we go out and we sit on the roof and we observe for 10 or 15 minutes completely quietly, and they write down what they see. And I did that one year just because I needed something to do, and it's become foundational, you know, to the way that my course ends up going.
That's probably true of all Macaulay teachers. You you come up with an idea, go, this will get me through today.
Yeah.
And it works so well that a certain number of those become traditional.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's when it stumbles across some type of way that we do need to live, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, there's almost a truth related to that, mm-hmm. that we have to take time, particularly in today's day and age, mm-hmm. where there is so much information coming at us, and we could be part of that as teachers. We could simply be more information.
Exactly.
But we don't want to do that. We want them to pause and to stop and to think. And my sense is that English, of many of the disciplines, in particular, English can really do that well. You can take that moment.
The definition of our journal is it's a place to observe. I say this is a place for you to observe the outside world, the world outside of you, and to respond to it. Mm. And it, you know, it's your journal, so you write about whatever you've seen or whatever made you want to respond. But the thing about eighth grade is it will be over the course of this year, and frankly bleeding on over into ninth grade, before some of them can really, really get that view of the outside world. That the maturing age, the maturing characteristics are so different for a whole year or more. Mm-hmm. That, you know, some people are really good at it early, and some take a long time to be able to see that outside world.
Sam, you then carry that on. You teach a poetry class to mm-hmm. seniors. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about sort of, is that maybe a culmination, and it's registered. I mean, there are guys that sign up for it and that love it, right? Which is not something I think a lot of younger folks necessarily think on the front end of, I'm going to love poetry. No, because of the way it's sometimes been taught. But you really engage that. Is that part of what that class is trying to continue to do, just to stop and to pause and to see how poets might look at something versus a prose type writing?
Yeah, it's kind of the premise that the poet sees the world differently. And I kind of inherited it from Kimmer. And I think when Kimmer taught it, you, the guys would go in, and for 30 minutes he would ramble on, and the fun was sort of what he was talking about. So it was kind of like a translation. And teaching seniors has its own challenges. First semester is great. Second semester, it can be come listen to Curran talk for 20 minutes, and we'll see what happens. But Cameron said, get them, you know, they've got to write. And so we read poetry, and we'll do it by genre and subject and topic and style. And so we focus on one sort of focal point, and we read some, but then we imitate and we parody, and we try to make that voice fit whatever it is we're writing about. So we're going to start our nature poem unit tomorrow, and we'll go read outside, probably covered because it's going to be raining. And then we'll say, what makes a nature poem? What is it that is it just a single big metaphor where we're talking about a waterfall, but it's actually something else? And they get to sort of piece together what that assignment looks like, and then they write it and we read everybody. So it's a pretty simple course, and I lead with, you've got to really work hard to do poorly in here, which is another attractive feature, I think, for a senior. But they sort of dictate what we read and what we write. And I think that agency and that ownership is helpful for buy-in, because they really are in charge of making the course a success or not, more so maybe than other years.
We're talking about Kimmer Anderson, a former teacher.
Kimmer Anderson, Yogi, however, and I wish somebody could do an impression, but we don't have that here. Yes, Kimmer Anderson.
One of the things that, Aaron, you mentioned was the voices, of needing to hear voices and the expanding voices. And I know in world literature, that's something that you all have focused on dramatically. And Sam, I want to come back to the senior electives in just a second. But talk to me about what that process is in terms of choosing the voices you're trying to expose these guys to.
I know that the course started more as a Brit Lit course. And then it just sort of slowly, as teachers sort of took one book out and put one book in, and it broadened. And then the actual process of choosing a book, I guess a few years ago, it just became apparent that, you know, that we had kind of been teaching the same thing, and that we did have a lot of like British voices in World Lit. And so I sat down. I was working in the Writing Center at the time, so I had a little bit more time to get on the Google, and you just start looking around. You're trying to find a book that, you know, comes from a place that, you know, we talk about South America and Asia and Africa, places where maybe we haven't taught a lot of voices from, and then you just try to find something that's accessible to the boys, something where, you know, the story is appropriate for teenagers, and it's something that will pull them in some way.
Sam, talk to me a little bit about some of the senior electives, because we, as a school, have really expanded the attempt to get a number of voices. And this is what's going on in English across the United States, trying to get a range of voices that may not have been heard as much. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about what sort of has happened under your leadership.
Well, and the beauty of that system, and it's been in place for as long as I've been here, is that we tell the guys what they're reading for 3 years in the high school, and then we say, okay, you get to pick now. And I think there are 12 or 11 different electives. We've got a poetry class. Next semester, it's basically an immigrant lit class, where it's American stories that might not necessarily be the American stories we would hear or read about. David Cook is teaching literature of race and racism, African-American literature, nonviolent literature, literature of gender studies, and what he calls literature of the heart. And having David teach all seniors is I think, going to really pay off. Cleve's got a contemporary lit course, which changes every year. He's got a couple books that he keeps in that section, but a lot of them are new over the summer. And he teaches fiction writing. And then Reno's sort of our academician, and he's got a tragedy course, a horror course that he's taught before, Irish Lit, and those core, and this is true maybe of 10th and 11th grade as well. The beauty of an independent school is that, and even in our department, I don't check off a book, or I don't You know, look, a teacher doesn't run a book list by me and say, can I do this? They're all empowered to teach whatever they want, and I think they're responsible in that because they know the gravity of those decisions. And we actually, three or four or five years ago, sort of audited our book list, and it was a really interesting discussion because we found really the trend was that the books that we kept teaching had young male protagonists. We looked at author, we looked at gender, we looked at race and ethnicity and geography, but the one thing that kept popping up was this idea of the Bildungsroman, which is a genre that tracks a young man's growth from youth to development, and it's got sadness involved, you have to lose something, and so we see this major trend, and I think any teacher that's been at Macaulay long enough and teaching English knows that's those are the books that the boys are going to be drawn to. And so knowing that, it's just a matter of what voices have we not heard historically. And so it's intentional, especially at the senior elective level, because the guys have had 3 years of practice, and a lot of them are capable maybe at that point of having some discussions that they maybe weren't mature enough for at ninth or 10th grade. And because they've signed up for them on their own, they're there and they want to be there, which also changes the attitude of a class.
Bill, in thinking about sort of where we are, we're located in Chattanooga, we're in the South, we're an all-boys school, there's a Christian focus. Are there certain books, are there certain ideas that we need to think about opening these guys' minds to, or exposing them to, or supporting them as they've developed? Are there certain things that might cause you to say, you know, this is really the book for this group, maybe 8th grade versus 12th grade versus 10th, obviously it's different, but that's what I want to do for them with this text.
8th grade is exceedingly hard to choose books for. I have a bias against young adult literature because it just seems to be checking boxes on certain things, and it's just a little simple, especially in an independent school and in 8th grade where I'm sending kids to 9th grade where the books are real and the books are big and bad. And so I've tried really hard to change the books around each year, and I have minor success with that. But frankly, like To Kill a Mockingbird still works with them. An old, little, small William Saroyan book, The Human Comedy, really works with 8th grade boys. Even Romeo and Juliet works with 8th grade boys. They like the fact that they've conquered it. They kind of like the love story and all of that. It's better, they like it better than Julius Caesar for sure. But the most popular book in the last 6 years, I took a chance on Neil Simon's Brighton Beach Memoirs. And it's got some really funny parts. And the Eugene, the main character, is a very typical teenager who thinks very typical teenage thoughts, all of which are not all that. You wouldn't hear them in Sunday school, let's put it that way. But the book, the play, is about family. And I told somebody, it is a family values play with some cuss words. Mm-hmm. And it's about this dysfunctional family that loves each other so much that the end, they're a mess until the end, and they get them at their act together and even begin to welcome over the ones that have escaped Nazi Germany. And I've only had one parent over all those 6 years complain about the language. And I just kind of brushed it off, to be honest with you, because I have too many boys at the end say, that was my favorite play, because it was because those people were real. You know, it's the... And I think that's part of it. The issues were real, the family was real. And the other thing was the teenage boy that is a little bit loose with his thoughts and his language, he's the most immature in the whole book. He's not the hero. And 8th grade boys recognize that. He's there and he stays immature, whereas everybody else grows. And it's a little bit of a commentary on the boys themselves. It's like if we keep acting goofy like this, we're no better than he is.
That's a powerful message to be able to get across in a text.
And it's tricky, you know. It's to find a book like that can reach them on that level and can sneak that lesson in. Because I never say that out loud. They're the ones that figure it out.
I liked what that idea that these people are real. I think that gets back to, you know, what we were talking about a minute ago too, where good writing is good writing. And so the same techniques that my students, I'm going to ask them to use to describe, you know, eating fried chicken for Sunday dinner, are going to be what Chimamanda Adichie uses to describe, you know, eating in this market in Nigeria. And, you know, and when I ask them to describe their neighborhood, you know, we're going to see that in Enrique's neighborhood. It's the same techniques, and it's the same beauty and sadness and all of those things. And so it's that good writing is what connects us to each other across humanity. And that's something that I think, you know, does transcend some of the other, you know, cuss words or politics or anything like that, you know.
It's not, one of the boys goes, I told him, I said, you're going to have to be mature to read this book. I'm going to ask you to go over a high hurdle here. But the maturity is not what you think. And at the end he said, it wasn't the words, was it? I said, no, it's not the words anybody can cuss. But what they did, I showed him a really quick clip of a scene where Eugene and his big brother hug as the big brother is leaving to go join the army. And I asked them to time the hug. And it's fully a little over 8 seconds. That's a long time for two people to hug. And then we just talk about what does that mean? It's almost one of those moments when other people other than me sort of tear up in the room. Two brothers hugging for eight seconds. And that's real.
That's very real.
And that, you know, and just before that, there had been a pretty bad word uttered. Not unlike things that you know, two brothers might say to each other. But it was the 8-second hug that they remembered.
That's the authenticity of it. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with these great folks. I'm Sumner McCauley, Dean of Faculty and Curriculum, and I thank you for joining us for this discussion with three faculty from our English department. We will resume our conversation in a few minutes, but as I reflect on what I've heard so far, what has stood out to me is McCauley's continued dedication to teaching the most basic elements of good communication, use of correct grammar, ability to analyze text and elucidate main themes, facility and fluency with language. What I hope is also emerging, and certainly will in the second half even more clearly, is our intention to broaden greatly the range of voices our students are exposed to, even as we help them sort through the cacophony created by the explosion of social media and constant information flow. As Bill Jamerson, Aaron Tucknell, and Sam Curran all note, we want to help our young men reflect deeply on what they are seeing and reading, and then to find their own voice, to understand they have important things to do and to say. This podcast is part of a series we are producing featuring the academic disciplines at Macaulay. Earlier, we posted a great discussion with members of our science department, and in coming weeks, we'll post discussions with other departments. One name you heard mentioned in both the science department discussion and this English department discussion is Kemmer Anderson, who recently retired after several decades teaching English on the Ridge. Kemmer inspired so many students in his poetry and literature classes, and I thought it'd be good to hear him read one of his poems. So let's listen to Kemmer Anderson, and then we'll return to our discussion.
Wild geese loose us. Like words, formations form. Wild geese break into a vocabulary of call and turn with a compass instinct for a flight path over Moccasin Bend. Language wings across the sky until their downy sounds disappear through gray clouds beyond river and mountain. Rolling syllables from angel wings, flutter from tongue and bill, lines shape into a V to leave us here on the ground with the conscious sound of nature, defined by words from a featherly lexicon of flight, riding skyward through the ear, beyond our earthbound rage, when gravity holds us in wingless words of unforgiveness.
Thanks to Kemmer for continuing to share his gifts of words with us. His abstract connections always bring a smile to my face. What a joy to hear his voice again. Now let's return to our discussion. Well, welcome back, folks. I want to jump in directly to this concept of social media, because in the past 5 years, social media has changed dramatically. Have you noticed, well, first we went through tweets, 140 characters, and then lengthened, and then quick bits here and there. Have you all noticed a change in the way in which students write, and has that forced you to alter how you teach to broaden how they look at the world or what they're talking about?
The biggest ramification I've seen in terms of social media is their attention span and their ability to sustain a discussion or a conversation without a distraction or without a break. I think the writing, maybe, I don't know that I've noticed something really tangible.
I have noticed that, you know, it used to be if you wanted to get a book across that was difficult, you know, like, you know, watch The Crucible, you know, watch it, or Hamlet, just watch it. And I've noticed that I do have to stop quite a bit while we're watching and sort of talk them through what have they just seen. They don't really key into an hour and a half or 2 hour long sort of viewing experience like they used to. And so I've noticed that fracturing of the attention span. But I would say the main thing I've noticed is the attention span. I haven't noticed a change in writing quality or reading, but I think that is also one reason why we have shifted to do some of the longer format stuff in class. Because, I mean, one thing that I'll say is that if you give the students the space to do it, they will do it. They're, not only are they capable of it, they need it. They need to sit and there are days when I'll have them start writing on just open topic, write about anything you want, and then I'll cut them off at 15 minutes. I mean, I think they're kind of, contrary to what you might think, they're kind of desperate to get into something and just stay in one thing and do it. So that's what I've seen.
Definitely the lessening of attention spans, and it's why I don't think I ever construct a plan for a class that isn't broken into 2, 3, if not 4 parts in a 50-minute class. And this is with 8th graders. And then eventually, the second semester, we might be able to do differently. With a play, I love to have them acted out. They like that. They like the 12 Angry Men remains one of their favorite pieces of literature because they like being those 12 angry men and seeing those different things in the, there are a lot of really great issues, talking about issues that are modern and contemporary. The whole stereotype is a big deal there. We talk about stereotypes, we talk about discrimination. And again, it's not political at all. It could be if we wanted it to be, but I don't have to say that. The lesson is too clear. In the writing, and this is just a picky grammar thing, but if I don't tell them otherwise, they don't bother with capitalizing things or putting in periods or commas or any of those other troublesome marks.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you don't need that in tweeting. Or I can always tell when a boy's written a journal entry on his phone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the phone journal entries are a little more challenging to read.
In paragraphs, they'll write it all in one fell swoop.
Yeah, big giant paragraph,
uh-huh.
And no punctuation.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a little bit like Faulkner, you know. It's got its Faulkner-esque.
Well, that's what they're aspiring to.
Exactly.
They know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Faulkner had voice to text, and was writing it in the car on the way home.
I remember very distinctly when I was a counselor at camp with a 9-year-old. Well, not a camp, but a 9-year-olds that I would choose to read Faulkner as we went to sleep, as they went to sleep. because it would only take one sentence. Now that one sentence might be four or five pages, but it was that would do it. So if there's a shorter attention span you're running into, that doesn't mean there's a lack of depth. And that's what I'm hearing.
Right.
So how do you build the class? How do you build instruction? How do you build your sequencing of novels or texts to allow you to draw them into that story of their life that they're reading?
They have to find a way to connect. And I think that's sort of like on the surface, like that's the secret of an English class. And especially in 10th grade, Naren and I have been pretty intentional about this the last 4 or 5 years. It's their sort of membership card and humanity and empathy and all those things that we uphold. But it starts with the recognition and sort of a caveat, when we read Kightner, you know, I'm not an Afghan American immigrant. I wasn't born in Kabul. And when you take that off the table, those literal-minded kids say, okay, well, then maybe there's something about this character that is similar to me. And they practice that, and they do it again and again, and maybe they even get tired of it. But a sophomore is pretty inward-looking. The world, as far as they see it, is primarily about themselves for the most part. And so when you ask a kid to write about himself, to think about himself, to sort of work through and flesh out what it is that makes him who he is, and you compare that with a great book as sort of a trampoline or a jumping off point, then they get okay doing it again. And so then it just becomes, okay, we're gonna shift to a different text. The idea is the same. We admit that this is good literature, and it's good because it says some sort of truth about the world. What is that truth, and how does it apply to you?
That's really interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
There are other thoughts. Go ahead, Aaron.
Well, I think it's interesting because although sophomores are very, they can be very inward looking, I've found that over the past 4 or 5 years, and I feel like we've hit this point a few times, but just really trying to help them cultivate an inner life has become something. So when I first came here, and even when I was teaching, when I was a TA at West Virginia, in the mid-2000s, the idea was like, well, these kids are talking on their phones all the time. That was the thing, and texting all the time. And we have to speed class up. I mean, constantly. Like, they need to be hopping up and hopping down and doing this and interacting with each other and talking and just, you know, like... But then it got to the point where you can't possibly speed class up faster than they are used to moving on their phones now. And so that idea of that inner voice and that inner self is this idea, though, of sort of like... slowing class down in places and taking the pacing where they kind of have to, and I've talked to them about this already, you have to have a conversation with yourself in your head. Like, you need to take time, you need to be in your head. Don't talk to your neighbor. You know, we're going to spread out and just write. Because that's something that they're on their computers or their phones all the time, but they're not necessarily cultivating that inner voice. But it's there.
And that's where that journaling that you all have talked about,
yeah,
which on the outside, someone might say, what do you mean you're just asking them to write about anything? Shouldn't you be asking them to write about the symbolism in this novel,
yeah,
or the character? But that's where you're saying that sense of just writing to get things out, to begin to get the story to come together.
Yeah.
That seems to be.
But that's where they begin to discover their own voice. Mm-hmm. I used to do an exercise where I'd tell them to put their heads down on the desk, and I said, when I tap you on the shoulder, you say, now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of their country. And they went, where'd that come from? So we had to get something shorter. But so I would walk around the room with their heads down, eyes closed, and I'd tap them on the shoulder. And they would utter, you know, now is the time for all good men, maybe that much. And I'd go around the room, and I was just constantly circling, and I tapped about 6 guys. And then I said, all right, everybody up. Do you know for sure who spoke? And they went, sure we do. You know, it was this guy or this guy, and they usually could name all of them. And I said, why do you know that? And they said, because that's just the way so-and-so talks. That's just the way he's got that accent. He talks real fast. He talks real slow. And I said, okay, well, that's your speaking voice, but you have a writing voice, too. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to early writing center stuff here 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. What is your writing voice? And journaling about whatever you want to, whatever you're passionate about, whatever's on your mind, whatever you've observed about the world today, is a step in finding and becoming comfortable with and ultimately confident with that writing voice.
in that journaling, they start in eighth grade. I mean, we have seniors that graduate that have been journaling since eighth grade, because they Bill got them started, and then they just kept going.
And in fact, Bill, you give them the journals that they wrote in eighth grade at graduation.
Well, that's their autobiography. That's the journal is more or less just taking notes during the year. The autobiography is a more finished product of five chapters that they figure out themselves. So I give them the finished product. Their journal lives until they graduate. It's a Google document. And so I do. In fact, I answered a senior wrote in his journal last night, and it was the journal he started in the eighth grade. It's a digital document. I wrote him a note about what he had said. Now, when he graduates, he'll lose that Macaulay address, and he'll have to, before that, if he wants to save all that journal, he'll have to do it intentionally.
What an amazing thing to think about a sequence of English classes that are not just next grade, next books. That's mm-hmm. it. There's a line that you're trying to trace through here, mm-hmm. and a growth. I mean, you said it really well, that inner personal voice. Aaron, you're an author.
Yes.
And you're writing stuff that we will purchase on Amazon.
Hopefully.
Bill and Sam may also be authors as well that I'm not aware of, and I'll ask for that support. But Aaron, talk about that process and maybe a little bit. Well, first of all, what is the book about? And then talk a little bit about how that's informed your sense of teaching writing.
Okay. So in the summers, mostly, I've been working on a book called A Cool Dip and a Little Dignity, A Social History of Swimming in the South. And that line, A Cool Dip and a Little Dignity, was given to me by the recently departed Kwame Lillard, who was a freedom rider, who one day he and his friend, on literally like their day off from running the Freedom Ride office, decided they would go down and they're both black, and they decided they would go down and try to get into the, like, pay their admission and go swim at the Centennial Park Pool in Nashville, Tennessee.
And that's your hometown.
That's where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I grew up going to Centennial Park all the time. And, you know, so then 2 days later, I mean, the way Kwame tells the story is actually kind of quite funny. I mean, you know, and sad, like so many things are. And then 2 days later, the response that surprised everyone was that they just closed all the pools in the city and drained them rather than deal with, this was 1961, so rather than deal with, you know, the progress that was occurring, they just closed all the pools and drained them. And I wrote an article about that for the Bitter Southerner about 5 years ago, and some presses saw it and wanted to know if I would write more, and I said, sure.
And Bitter Southerner is a literary magazine.
Mm-hmm. It's an online publication that deals with Southern issues, basically. So just everything you can think of. One of the most popular pieces is a photo essay of Waffle Houses. So they do a lot of interesting things.
But I get vocab lists from the Bitter Southern.
Yeah.
It's good. And Garden and Gun, for that matter.
And it was really an honor to get to write for them and to get to tell that story, especially since the major players have since passed away. And so, yeah, so a press said, would you write more on that? And I said, oh, yeah, I have plenty of stuff. Yeah, I'll write more. 5 years later, still working on that one, because you realize, and this ties into how I teach, it's both simple and daunting at the same time. It feels like a true story that I want to tell well, and I know how to do that. And then at the same time, it feels incredibly complex and so daunting and so difficult to tell. And I think, but I love it. I mean, I just, it gets me up in the morning in the summer. I get up at the same time in the summer as I do in the school year. I just wake up with the sun and I start writing. I love it. But it also is hard and sometimes frightening, and sometimes I think I don't know where I'm going. And I think that has given me, that's renewed my sense of how that is for the students to write. Where it seems simple on the surface. A lot of the stuff we ask them to do, yeah, go write about a meal that makes your family, you know, check back in with me on Monday. Like, seems kind of simple, but then you get into it and it's complex and overwhelming. And for me, this press wants this thing from me, and I hope I'm doing it right. And for them, it's this teacher wants this thing from them, and every teacher's a little different, you know. So it's given me a much better sense of what it feels like, that feeling of sort of stumbling through in the dark sometimes, and you just have to write the next word. And that's something I try to communicate to them, that it's not easy, but it can be really beautiful and valuable, and you know, gets you connected to the world in a way that I don't think anything else can.
Bill and Sam, as you listen to Aaron, what resonates in particular, beautifully described Aaron, what resonates out of that as you think about your own teaching?
I was just sitting here thinking two things. One, this that it's 5 years she's been working on it, and it could be five more before she finishes it, or more or less.
Oh.
I know you groaned about that. But part of her suffering is that she spent a whole month in New Orleans this summer researching this topic. So, aside from the humidity, it was a great place to go do research.
It was.
And so I love that the stories she's coming back with are from Nashville and from New Orleans and all the places that drained their pools and said, oh, we've got problems with the mechanics, and I'm sorry, but the pool's closed for the summer. The most transparent of bigoted responses, mm-hmm. and the South just sort of lived with that,
mm-hmm.
and promoted that. No, I'm jealous. The idea of getting up in the summer and the first thing I do besides coffee is to start writing. I haven't found the thing that I'm in love with enough to do that, or I'm not sure I'm disciplined enough to do that. So I have this huge respect for that.
My writing stops at sophomore papers, so that I can write you a B- comment in about 10 seconds. And I really do love that, and I don't know if they read the comments or not. I really hope they do, because I do spend a lot of time on them. But the question of it, I'm inspired by Aaron, and the cool thing, and this is the English department is the best, tell science and history, all that. But Aaron and I stayed after school last week, and we were there's a line in the Kite Runner that we read that it may be unfair, but what happens in a day or even a moment can change the course of a lifetime. And Aaron was talking about this guy that she's writing about in this book that became sort of the, and jump in if I'm summarizing wrong, sort of became the face of the racist response, this white hotel owner in St. Augustine, and this picture of him that sort of blew up, went viral is what we would say, but and the story of his life is adds such depth to that, but it's that thing that he's remembered for. So this discussion where what we're reading and teaching the sophomores, this idea that you can make a mistake that can dictate the way your life goes, happens in real life to this guy that Aaron's been researching and writing about. And it's this weird sort of confluence of fiction and reality that is at sort of the core of what we talk about the guys with. You know, is it unfair that you can make a decision, and if it's the wrong one, it can dictate the rest of your life? We talked about that for 20 minutes today. And sophomores, I think, maybe they don't recognize that it's true or not, but they certainly have a lot of opinions about whether it's fair. So it was cool.
Yeah, and I think, and going back into character and things like that, which we talk about, I think both Amir in The Kite Runner and this hotel owner, James Brock in St. Augustine, the world did not prepare them, and they did not prepare themselves for that moment when it was all on the line. You know, they both came up in cultures and places where that were hateful towards a certain group of people, and they were not the characters that stood up against that, right? That like when it all, you know, it's this idea of sort of, what is it, action creates character, right? So in that moment, you know, nothing they had done, even though they lived complex lives, they weren't, you know, cartoon monsters or anything like that. In that moment when it was all on the line, they didn't have the tools or the equipment to not do what they did. That's an interesting framing of it's a mistake that's going to define you for the rest of your life, but so much of that is where you are and who's around you and who you are, and then once you get older, sort of who you choose to surround yourself with, and then it just comes up to this moment. And
these are remarkable life lessons to mm-hmm. think about, and things that I think, again, a normal English class, the best English classes are the ones that do this. that ask the guys to think deeply about who they are, what they're about, how they make decisions, but not in a surface way. Mm-hmm. And using literature to get at that.
Yeah, even a very small line in a very small book of Mice and Men. There's a scene where Curly's wife is trying to console Lenny because he's squeezed too hard and killed a puppy. And she looks at him and goes, he's just a mutt. You can get another one. And I asked the guys about, what is a mutt? And we talk about that and, you know, what constitutes a mutt. And she says the equivalent of this, we're a nation of mutts. She didn't say it that way, but we talk about that because that becomes, you know, how could someone get the idea that we're only a nation of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants when in fact we've been a nation of mutts forever? And look at all the amazing things that has created. Yeah. And again, it's not a political statement. It's just go look. You know, look at the classroom that I teach and the different variety of students that I have. If I drag out one of my old elementary school pictures, it's just boring. They're all the same color. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that I missed out on all of these different people and religions and cultures that our guys get and that really any good public school around here is going to hopefully get. I missed out on that, and it makes me sad.
So it's a lot of it's exposure, it sounds like to me, that you're trying to give, both allowing the space for the guys in the classrooms that you have to share who they are, to begin to understand who they are, first of all, and then begin to find ways to express that in ways that other folks say, I want to listen more, I want to understand this more. And then, for that matter, to expose well beyond the classroom setting with stories that we don't necessarily have represented here, and that there's a much larger connection. I mean, Aaron, go back to your sense of it's human. It's authentically human. That's kind of what this seems to be about. Mm. It's a pretty amazing thing for English to do, and that may be a good place for us to end. Thank you, three of you, for a great conversation.
Thank you, Summer.
Thank you.
Thanks.